Chris Boyd. Up next on Think, the double life of a young attorney, corporate lawyer by day, clemency crusader by night. Brittany K. Barnett will join us this hour to talk about how she worked to get 7 clients freed from sentences that had all but guaranteed they would die in prison for nonviolent offenses and in some cases with no prior criminal history. Barnett is proud of being able to help, but argues the best solution is to eliminate mandatory sentencing laws that leave judges no choice but to hand down life sentences for drug crimes. Our conversation starts after a short break. The war on drugs is supposed to protect us from addictive substances that shatter families and ruin lives. To fight that war, the criminal legal system goes after people, people who get caught up in trafficking, selling, even just using cocaine or heroin or meth or marijuana. These are people who have put themselves in bad situations, to be sure. But is it necessary? Is it even helpful to take them away from society for the rest of their lives? From KERA in Dallas, this is Think. I'm Chris Boyd. As a student, Brittany K. Barnett had dreams of a lucrative corporate career. She was hired by a top firm right out of law school. The thing you might not have guessed watching her rising through the ranks in her impeccable tailored outfits was that after work every day, she had assigned herself a whole other career, fighting for mercy for pro bono clients trapped by mandatory life sentences for relatively minor drug offenses, sometimes as a result of their first ever nonviolent brush with the law. Barnett understood that these clients were not scary arch criminals, but regular, relatable people who had made mistakes. And she understood this in part because her own mother had spent years behind bars for becoming addicted to crack cocaine. Barnett is the founder of several nonprofits and enterprises, including the Buried Alive Project and Girls Embracing Mothers. Her new book is called A Knock at Midnight, a story of hope, justice, and freedom. Brittany, welcome to Think.
Hi, Chris. Thank you so much for having me.
So you first met your eventual pro bono client, Sharonda Jones, through a YouTube video, and your first thought was you could relate to her. What kind of life did she have apart from the events that put her in prison on a life sentence?
Sharonda had a very normal, regular life for a Black woman from the rural South. She grew up in Terrell, Texas. Had a daughter of her own who was 8 years old and was an entrepreneur. She had dreams of opening her own restaurant. She had actually opened a small restaurant in Dallas on Lamar Street called Cooking on Lamar, and she had dreams of expanding the restaurant. Before then, she owned her own hair salon and was truly known, you know, for her impeccable hairstyling. She was a woman who had goals and dreams, you know, and unfortunately, just like my own mom and myself, she had her goals and dreams shaped by her social circumstances, you know, but she still made her way.
How had she gotten mixed up with people who were trafficking and selling drugs? She never had a goal of like being a drug seller or anything like that herself.
She did not have a goal of being a drug dealer. She needed money. And there was a couple that she knew who was looking for drugs. And Sharonda knew a guy in Houston who sold lots of drugs. And with Sharonda being the mutual friend between both of these parties, she became what you would call a drug mule. And with that, Chris, you know, a handful of times, she would traffic powder cocaine down the interstate between these two parties and, you know, get paid here or there $1,000, a couple thousand sometimes.
It's so ironic because she's taking this money she's making and like investing it back into her small business and in her daughter's education. Like she was not looking to make huge profits to get into this business.
Exactly. There were no large sums of money. She was using the money to help her survive. unfortunately. You know, she was also taking care of her mother, who was quadriplegic and had been quadriplegic since Sharonda Jones was 4 years old. You know, and so she was a small entrepreneur trying to make her way and got involved in the illegal practice of selling drugs.
I feel like you do a really good job in this memoir of both portraying what a hero your mother was to you and how strong she is, and also explaining how devastating it was when she became addicted. First of all, tell us about your memories of your mom from before she used drugs.
Oh, my mom was so fun, funny. My parents were both young, teenagers when I was born. And she spent all of her spare time, you know, catering to my sister and I. I grew up in the rural South in East Texas, a very small town called Bogota, Texas, with about 1,200 people. And my mom would take us to the county fairs. We go to the circus. We would play board games like Candyland or card games like Uno. She taught us to make French toast. You know, we had a very close-knit family, you know, amongst my mom and my sister and I.
And your mom was, she had you and your sister quite young. She and your dad were, I guess, very much in love, and then it kind of blew up quickly between them. But she still had dreams for her own education that she worked really hard to fulfill.
She did. My mom wanted to be a nurse. And at a young age, I was in the kindergarten, you know, and I remember my mom working in the evenings, and in the morning she would get up and go to nursing school. She put herself through nursing school with two young toddlers in tow. I remember mornings of her dropping us off at daycare before the sun was even out so that she could make her classes in time. And then with her working in the evenings, you know, we didn't really have reliable transportation at the time. And I remember my grandfather, who lived right down the street, would drop his truck off at the end of our driveway on his way home from work, you know, and he would walk the rest of the way home just so my mom could have transportation to fulfill her dreams. And so she was definitely our hero.
Sounds like she didn't get a lot of breaks during that time.
She didn't.
How old were you when you first found a crack pipe in her pocket?
I was 10, a very tender 10-year-old girl.
Did you know what it was?
You know what, Chris? Strangely enough, I did. You know, growing up as an 80s baby, you know, this is the mid-90s by now, and drug culture was all around us, you know, whether it was through the Just Say No programs like DARE or through pop culture and TV, movies like New Jack City, you know, I knew exactly what that pipe was.
Did you confront her about it?
I did not. I didn't confront her about it. One, because I was only 10.
Yeah.
But two, you know, once I realized what was happening and that my mom was using crack cocaine at 10, I wanted to fix her, you know? And as a child, wanting to fix their parents, because we see disaster unfolding in our little bitty arms length away, you know, and not realizing at the time that I can't fix her and it's not my burden to fix her.
So your mom's husband at the time, who seems like a really good guy, finally realizes she needs rehab, and you and your sister are sent to live with your dad and his family, who were wonderful to you. This thought, though, I mean, I just can't even imagine the pain you had when you felt at 10 like you were somehow abandoning your mom who needed you, even though you couldn't possibly have had the power to fix her.
Yeah, you know, and it's looking back in hindsight, it's illogical, right? You know, to think that. But at 10, there's just something there when your parent is fallen, you know, your hero's on ground zero, and you don't realize your brain can't process the fact that you can't fix them. And so leaving my mom, you know, was hard. It was hard.
So rehab didn't last for her, not that first time. What was it like when your mother was high? Like, how did things change in your house?
It was like an emotional roller coaster. Like, I remember the mood swings from very mellow to angry. I remember her sleeping a lot, the late night arguments between my mom and stepdad, her beginning to miss work. You know, the changes were subtle at first, and then they just, it seemed like our world was overturned overnight.
Were you afraid of her?
As her addiction got worse. I was. I was afraid of the person she had become. And the fear was because you didn't know what to expect. You know, there's one thing about addiction, and it's that it impacts the entire family, you know, and there were times I can definitely say I was in fear of not knowing what to expect.
I gather also living in a small town, there's the fear of like everyone's going to know that my mom is addicted.
Exactly. That's so true. There's, you know, my small piece of rural Texas where everybody knows everybody. That means everybody knows everybody's business. Or at least think they do. And so there was always a fear of people finding out and that stigma. One thing I can say, though, is that even with all of that and my mom's addiction and things we went through, we had so much love from our extended family, my stepdad, my mom even, you know. And I talk about in the book, I quote a line from a Nikki Giovanni poem called Nikki Rosa, in which the line, Nikki writes, Black love is Black wealth. And they'll probably talk about my hard childhood and never understand that all the while I was quite happy. And I love that quote because it just shows just the nuance and complexity of life. And even dealing with such a challenging, tumultuous time, we were so surrounded by love, even from outside of our home to the community.
Your father also grappled with addiction for a while. He got clean before your mother. Did you grow up worried that with that genetic legacy, you might be at risk of addiction yourself?
No, I never worried that I would be at risk of addiction myself, but I was very determined not to go down that path.
What did you feel like you could do to stay off that path?
I think I internalized the notion of succeeding academically. You know, that success would help me stay off that path. And because I internalized that on my own, you know, I really, really devoted myself to my studies and in school.
And you were like the queen of school. You were always good at school.
I was always good at school. I was.
My guest is Brittany K. Barnett. She's an attorney and entrepreneur focused on social impact investing. She's written a book called A Knock at Midnight, a story of hope, justice, and freedom. We'll come back to the conversation in 2 minutes. You're You're listening to Think. I'm Chris Boyd, speaking this hour with attorney and entrepreneur Brittany K. Barnett. She secured executive clemency from President Barack Obama for a number of her pro bono clients. Her new book is called A Knock at Midnight, a story of hope, justice, and freedom. Brittany, if I understand correctly, your mother's only crime was continuing to be addicted to drugs and buy and use them. She never hurt anyone, is that right?
That's right. My mother caught a case out of Red River County, and she was totally high. It was drug-induced. She was placed on probation, and she could not comply with the conditions of her probation, specifically as it related to drug testing. And my mother failed her drug test over and over again. She received more probation. She continued to fail her drug test. And ultimately, at one of the violations, she was sentenced to prison. You know, instead of the treatment that she desperately needed, my mom was incarcerated.
What do you remember about visiting her in prison?
Oh, Chris. When one person goes to prison, the entire family goes to prison. Hmm. I just remember how dehumanizing the entire experience was. There was one time, I will never forget this. It was my first visit with her in prison. And I have had extended family members go to prison. But there's something about it when it's your mama. It's a primal wound. And I remember going to visit her in Gatesville, Texas. And I had never been to a prison before. And I just was so excited to have a contact visit and hug my mama. I wanted to smell her and could not wait to get to her, because even with all we endured, my love for my mama is unconditional. And I get to the prison and I go through the metal detector and I look around the prison visitation room at the other women and their families hugging and laughing. I don't see my mom. And because she hadn't been at the prison for 60 days, we did not get a contact visit. I had to visit her through the glass and talk to her through phones. And oh, Chris, when I tell you, there is something so deceptive about that 3-inch plexiglass at a prison where you are so close to your loved one, but it feels like you're on different planets. And that plexiglass was such a barrier to my maternal bond with my mama, and it prevented the hug I wanted. It prevented the kiss I needed, you know, and so we had to make do. And I remember her putting her hand up to the glass and me putting my forehead there. And the memory that stuck with me the most through that, Chris, is a little pair of tiny lip prints that I saw on that plexiglass where some other child had tried to reach their mama before me. And that is such a vivid memory that even though it was 14 years ago, you know, I will never forget it.
So you, as a kid, watched The Cosby Show or maybe reruns of The Cosby Show, and you thought, wow, Claire Huxtable is awesome. She's a, you know, a Black woman. She's a lawyer. She's got it all together. How had that dream of being a lawyer faded for you by the time you started your undergraduate education?
You know, by the time I was in high school, I think it was, I had lost sight of my lawyer dream. Like you said, I had always wanted to be a lawyer. I adored Claire Huxtable. But I think in hindsight, and especially as I was writing the book, that I lost sight of that dream, mostly because there were no lawyers in my rural East Texas community, let alone Black women lawyers, you know, for me to look up to.
And so,
and because of that lack of representation, you know, I felt becoming a lawyer was out of my league.
So you became an accountant first, What made you think you wanted to go back and do this thing? I mean, you were out of college. You could have been done, but it just, I guess, kept gnawing at you, this dream you had.
Yes, it was always a dream that, though I lost sight of it, I was always holding on to the grip, even in my peripheral vision, if you will. And I was studying for the CPA exam. I got a bachelor's and master's in accounting, and I was going to take the exam for Texas to be a certified public accountant. And one of my mentors, I was borrowing his books to study because I didn't have a lot of money. My mom was in prison at the time. And I remember just seeing what he would say, you know, hey, you know, I'm thinking about going to law school. And he said, oh, you should definitely go to law school. I'm going to be starting at SMU Dedman School of Law in the fall. And here was someone who was my peer, had been a mentor for me. He was an accountant. And I remember being so happy for him, but also thinking, wait a minute. Now, if he can go to law school, I know I can go to law school. And from that moment on, from that representation, that proximity, I set my sights on becoming a lawyer.
You had really the foresight to know it would be helpful for you to have a mentor you could relate to. So you talk about how you found a woman who gave you lots of ongoing support.
Yeah, so as I mentioned, I didn't know any lawyers. So here I am, an accountant at PricewaterhouseCoopers, working in downtown Dallas. I am wondering, you know, about this law school process and this application process, but I didn't know any lawyers to even give me any guidance on what it was like. And Baker Boz, an international law firm, was located in the same building as my job at PricewaterhouseCoopers. And I remember going to their website, and the first Black woman lawyer I saw, Krista Brown Sanford, I emailed her. And I told her that, I think I apologized initially from this random email from a stranger, but I told her I worked in the same building and I would love to meet her at Starbucks for coffee because I wanted to go to law school and I was in hope she could give me some guidance. And Krista met me at the Starbucks. She did not hesitate. And she took my hand in that moment at that Starbucks and she has not let it go since then.
Which is really impressive because you describe, you know, just how much work she had and it you know, taking on that kind of mentorship role is not nothing. And she really wanted to do that for you.
She did. And I am so grateful that she did. And because she did, I make it a part of my life, you know, to be able to reach out and reach back and do the same. She devoted a lot of her time to our relationship and helping steer me through the law school application process, through law school, and I am forever grateful for Krista.
Okay, so you decided you wanted to go to law school. It wasn't, as I understand it, it wasn't like because my mom went to prison. You just wanted to be an attorney. In fact, you wanted to be like a corporate attorney and make decent money. And but you're still in law school and people, you know, because there weren't a lot of lawyers in your small town, you're like the lawyer that people know, even though you're still in school.
Yeah, I wanted to be a corporate lawyer. I wanted the Claire Huxtable power suit, the briefcase. I was an accountant, you know, and I love business. I love getting intimate with companies, and I just felt practicing corporate law would be a natural gravitation after my accounting experience, and had no interest in criminal law. But people where I grew up, they just hear law school. You know, I don't even think it processes that I'm a student, and I don't think it processes that just because you're a lawyer doesn't mean you know everything about the law. You know, and I did. I started getting a lot of calls from from people just wanting help, and all of the help was related to the criminal legal system.
So there was a kid that you had known growing up, and his story really, really struck you. Can you talk about him?
Yes, Keon Mitchell. He was a childhood friend, I think maybe 2 years older than me. He grew up in Paris, Texas, close to where I'm from. And at the age of 23, he was a college student and was arrested on college campus and charged with federal drug conspiracy. And I remember during that time, he went to trial and he got life. And, you know, we talked about small towns and how everybody feels they know everything. And we knew that Keon was likely involved in drug dealing. But we knew that Keon wasn't involved in drug dealing enough to get a life sentence. We didn't understand it. And looking back, I think it was this initial shock of life for drugs. And then it was like, oh, well, this is rural East Texas justice. And we thought, or I personally thought, that Keon's case was an anomaly. You know, this is something that happens here. You know, we see in courts every day where people here in Paris, Texas, and Clarksville, Texas, and they're getting these astronomical sentences. And we thought his case was just tied to that.
But in fact, he was affected by federal sentencing laws, right? The judge didn't have a whole lot of leeway in his case.
He was, you know, and I learned that once I went to law school and I interned for a federal judge in Houston, in the Southern District of Texas, and I would sit in and observe these drug trials and drug sentencing. And the more that I learned, I really understood that there's a bigger problem here than just East Texas. You know, there's some systemic issues with the law.
This is Think. I'm Chris Boyd. All right. So Keon's father had contacted you and said, what can you do? Because he was affected by these federal sentencing laws for what was classified as a federal crime, like appealing the case wasn't going to do any good. How did you start thinking about clemency as a possible way to have him not die in prison for something that he did when he was in his early 20s?
I began to research and just learn more. I took a course at SMU, Stedman School of Law, on critical race theory. And in this course, I was determined to try to understand the law that allowed Keon to be sentenced to life. And in this course, I also came across the case of Sharonda Jones because I wanted to humanize the issue. I wanted my SMU law classmates to see the heartbeat behind the numbers, to see that these are real people impacted by these laws. And as I worked on Keon's case and Sharonda's, looking for avenues to the court, I found there were none. And I learned through a family friend, honestly, who had been to prison herself and received clemency from President Bill Clinton, I learned what clemency was about and thought, wait a minute, this may be an option for us. Actually, this is the last option for us.
Can you explain for those of us without law degrees what clemency actually means?
Absolutely. So clemency to me is where justice meets mercy. And it is a power granted exclusively to the president through the Constitution. And there are two forms of clemency. One is a sentence commutation that reduces your sentence, and the other is a pardon that completely forgives you for the offense.
So how do you go about getting this for a client?
Oh, I started with Sharonda Jones. And oh, Chris, it was a journey. One, I was a corporate lawyer by then, practicing corporate law, and had no idea about the criminal law other than what I taught myself. And I realized that in this process of where justice meets mercy, the key to me is that heartbeat. How do I present Sharonda Jones as much more than a prisoner number, as much more than a woman who was convicted of a federal drug offense? And in that, I took to really merging my legal experience with my lived experience. And that intersection for me is where my heart lie, to be able to present these cases to the president in a way where he would see and agree with me that justice should meet mercy here. And what I didn't realize at the beginning until I got in the cases further was this is a long process. These cases go through multiple levels of review through the Department of Justice, levels of review through the White House Counsel's Office before it even makes it to the president's desk. You know, I think some people may think it just goes directly to the president decides, but it is a lengthy process, you know, and I learned through this process that it is definitely just important to keep the faith.
My guest is attorney and entrepreneur Brittany K. Barnett. She secured executive clemency from President Barack Obama for a number of clients and is the founder of nonprofits and enterprises, including the Buried Alive Project and Girls Embracing Mothers. Her memoir is called A Knock at Midnight, a story of hope, justice, and freedom. You're listening to Think. I'm Chris Boyd. My guest this hour is attorney and entrepreneur Brittany K. Barnett, who has founded nonprofits, including the Buried Alive Project and Girls Embracing Mothers. She secured executive clemency for a number of clients from President Barack Obama, and she's written a memoir called A Knock at Midnight, a story of hope, justice, and freedom. Brittany, what's so interesting to me is that you actually, other clients came to you or family members came to you and asked for your help. With Sharonda, you approached her, and the first thing she said to you was, "Don't bother. Attorneys have promised to help me before, and then they all disappear."
Yes, she had about had it with lawyers, leaving her and her family for money, making empty promises, you know, and just not seeming to really care about her freedom. And so her response to me after I told her I was a law student and I come across her case online and then I wanted to help her, her response was very cool. You know, it was, "I wish you well in your studies," and, you know, very, very cool in that way. She wasn't too convinced just yet.
Why were you convinced that it was really important, not just for her, but to you personally, to help her? What was it about her story?
You know, I saw so much of myself in Sharonda. When I was in high school, Chris, I dated a drug dealer. And I grew up in an area and during a time, an environment where some form of involvement with drugs was the norm. It seemed like you either knew someone selling drugs or you knew someone using them. And on a couple of occasions, I drove my boyfriend to get drugs. And even though we didn't talk about it, I knew what he was doing. You know, I knew what he was going in that house to get. And thankfully, I escaped that situation, which had turned violent in and of itself. But when I look back and I learn more about this overreaching conspiracy law and how easy it is for a conviction to be obtained with federal conspiracy. I mean, you just need two or more people to agree to be involved in drugs. And I thought about how I could have been Shawanda Jones. Like, even though I didn't know anything that was going on, nothing in depth about drug dealing, I was driving a car, you know, and it really just hit home for me, like, in my gut. And so I just began to fight for Shawanda's life as if it were my own, because, Chris, it really was.
Help me understand this, though. You have this, like, high-powered corporate law job. It's not like a little part-time job where you've got all this spare time. What was your life like in these years when you were trying to do both?
You know, that's all I thought about, was getting Shawanda free, getting my other clients free, just how their freedom was so intertwined with my own, it seemed. You know, the law was wrong. Completely wrong. And so I wanted to help right this wrong, but I also loved my corporate job. I loved the art of the deal. You know, I loved to be able to be a part of something, you know, so much bigger than myself, and be able to literally transform companies overnight, it seemed, you know, just the excitement of it all. And I just went through the motions of it all. I think, looking back now, I think if I had a stop in the moment to think about it, I would have just dropped all the balls. I was juggling, you know, and so I just was moving on this spiritual velocity or inertia, if you will, you know, that I must continue. And, you know, one thing, my grandpa, you mentioned I live with my grandparents. I'm very close with my grandparents. And my grandpa used to tell me as a little girl, and I'd be venting to him about my challenges, he'd say, it ain't nothing but a step. For a step, a big girl. You just got to keep on stepping. And so I would just keep on stepping.
The clemency process, as you describe it, is, and these are your words, maddeningly opaque. So what happens? You send off all this paperwork, you send off your appeal, and then you wait?
And then you wait, and you hear nothing. And there's no status checks, there's no updates along the way. You wait, you know. And in Shawanda's case, we waited 6 months, then a year passed, then a year and a half passed, you know. And it's just, it's maddening. It's mental violence to me.
So you were really happy to get each and every one of your clients a better deal. And I don't want to go into too much detail. I hope that people will pick up the book and read the other stories. But ultimately, you think the real solution is to change the criminal justice system. So you're not arguing the fact that most of the people you represented had done something wrong. What your concern is these life sentences, or in one case, 16 life sentences given to a single individual in connection with the same circumstance. How could we fix the system so that people are not sentenced in the future to the extent that they basically pay with the rest of their lives?
Yeah, as you mentioned, you know, there is no doubt in my clients accept full responsibility that they had some dealings in drugs. But those dealings should not have garnered a fundamental death sentence. You know, you have people like my client, Shawanda Jones. It was her first ever offense, felony or otherwise. Shawanda had never even been in jail for a traffic ticket before. Or my client like Alice Johnson, who was granted clemency from Donald Trump a couple of years ago, also her first offense. And you have people serving the same amount of time as the Unabomber. And I just want people first to sit with that and feel any discomfort that comes from that. And through that, really think of, do I support a criminal legal system that is going to send people like Shawanda to prison for life? You know, and with that, the solution for me is much bigger than reforms here or there, Chris. We have to completely reimagine what justice looks like. And we have to reimagine what justice looks like with a human-centered approach. And to me, that's the starting place for us to come up with real impactful solutions to this problem. Because when I look as a social entrepreneur, you know, it's critical for me to find ways to invest in the genius and ingenuity that I've seen personally trapped in America's cages. And so we have to find ways to help people thrive, not merely survive. And so when we come up and we think of solutions and ways to reimagine the system, I hope that people listening and that read the book will see that the true loss of mass incarceration, it isn't just the lives stolen by injustice. It's the beauty and brilliance that each person incarcerated might have contributed to our world, you know, if their lives hadn't been stolen. And so we have to find a way to end this brutal cycle because our collective future depends on it. And we have to do that through this reimagining process.
When you write in the book about the 100-to-1 crack to powder cocaine sentencing laws, are you just using an expression here, or is there literally 100 times as much penalty for dealing crack cocaine as powder cocaine?
It is literal. There was a ratio implemented in the 1986 Anti-Drug Abuse Act that punished crack cocaine much more severely than powder cocaine. So the 100-to-1 ratio was born. So Chris, you could have 500 grams of powder cocaine. I could have only 5 grams of crack cocaine, and you and I will receive the same sentence in prison. And it's not lost on anyone, you know, that during the times, you know, more affluent white people were using powder cocaine, and much of the crack cocaine was found and used in the Black community. And so this 100-to-1 ratio, as more research was done, became this extremely arbitrary number implemented by Congress, to the extent that it was denounced years later, you know, even by the Sentencing Commission, who found that crack and powder cocaine are just two forms of the same drug. I mean, you can't even have crack without powder. And so they found just how arbitrary and how much racial inequity, you know, bled through that 100-to-1 ratio.
This is Think. I'm Chris Boyd. And just to be clear here, and I'm not pro-cocaine in any form, but it's not like crack cocaine is somehow more addictive or more lethal. It's just a different, as you said, a different delivery form of the same drug.
Exactly. There were reports way back when that crack was more addictive, it caused more violence. So all of those reports have since been denounced through scientific research. You know, it's just not true.
How have your clients done after clemency, reintegrating into a world where even if you've been released from prison, society tends to look at you as like a criminal for life?
My clients are adjusting very well. You know, they are working to live their lives in a way that helps to shatter the stigma surrounding incarceration. The same as my mom, you know, she's been home over a decade now and sober and doing amazing, you know, working as a nurse at a drug recovery center of all places, you know. And so they live their lives to show people, you know, this is what freedom looks like. And I'm so empowered by them every single day. You know, Sharonda Jones lives in Dallas, Texas, right down the street from me. She's one of my best friends. We talk every day, you know, and she had this passion for cooking and she still has it. And I am so honored to say that Sharonda Jones recently purchased a food truck that she's going to call Fed Up. And she is going to hire formerly incarcerated people to work in her food truck. And just to see her cooking and doing what she loves, you know, and spreading so much joy, you know, freeing clients from prison, it isn't just about their freedom. It's just also about how they'll positively impact the world and each person they encounter. And so watching the ripple effect of my clients' freedom, oh, it puts my heart at such joy. Like words cannot even begin to touch how elated I am to see them succeeding and, as we say in our group, living life after life.
Have you had to turn down anyone who asked for your help seeking clemency or some kind of criminal appeal?
Unfortunately, I have many, many times, and it's only because I'm only one person, you know, and we have a nonprofit that we operate through. And if we had more capacity and, you know, resources, financial or otherwise, to hire more lawyers, we could take more cases. But the problem and the issue is so massive, Chris, that one person can't fix it all.
You mentioned your client, Alice Johnson, who was granted clemency by President Trump. Has the Trump administration sort of kept up the rate of clemency at a rate similar to President Obama?
No, the rate of clemency now is far behind that of President Obama. President Obama had a historic clemency initiative where he was prioritizing clemency cases for people serving time in prison for that 100-to-1 ratio that I mentioned. And President Obama granted more clemencies than any modern day president combined. And we haven't seen that trend during this administration.
How did you decide it was time to leave your corporate job and focus exclusively on what had been sort of your pro bono work outside of work?
You know, it took me a while to get the courage and strength to resign from corporate law because I loved it so much. But after looking deep within myself, Chris, and being so proximate to my clients, there was just nothing more urgent than freedom.
Brittany K. Barnett is an attorney and an entrepreneur focused on social impact investing. She's the founder of several nonprofits and enterprises, including the Buried Alive Project and Girls Embracing Mothers. Her memoir is called A Knock at Midnight, a story of hope, justice, and freedom. Brittany, thanks so much for taking the time to tell us your story.
Thank you so much for having me.
You can like our page on Facebook. We're on Twitter at KERA Think. Subscribe to our podcasts free wherever you get your podcasts by searching for KERA Think, or listen to what you've missed on our website, think.kera.org. Again, I'm Chris Boyd. Thanks for listening. Have a great day.